Desperate Deserts, a horrible geography book by Anita Gennari, illustrated by Mike Phillips, read by Vienna Vance. Introduction. Geography. What on earth is it all about? Some geography teachers drone on and on about far-flung places you've never heard of, using lots of posh words even they can't spell. Is this what your horrible geography lessons are like? Today's lesson is all about Aeolian Transportation. That's the posh way of saying a blast of wind. No, not that sort of wind. The sort that whips the sand up into sand dunes in the desert.
Don't we skip a page?
We shall begin in the Kyzylkum. Kyzylkum, part of the Turkestan Desert in Central Asia. See what I mean about spelling?
What is she going on about?
Dunno. Sounds like gibberish to me. Careful, you're beginning to sound like a geography teacher. You've accidentally used a horribly technical desert word. A gibber is a stony desert plain. You'll be setting yourself homework next. Luckily, not all geography is as desperate as this. Some bits are positively sizzling with excitement. Take deserts, for example. Don't listen to your gibbering geography teacher. Deserts are one of the most brilliant bits of geography ever. To find out exactly how brilliant, try the simple experiment to turn your bedroom into a desert. Go into your bedroom and put all the lights on. Then turn the heating up full. This will make your room nice and bright and hot, almost like a real desert. Then chuck a truckload or two of sand and gravel all over the floor. Plant a nice clump of palm trees, a few of your mom's best pot plants would do. And if you're feeling really ambitious, get down to some digging and pile up some of the sand into a soaring sand dune. Congratulations, you've got your own desperate desert. Sort of. If your grown-ups start moaning like mad, smile sweetly and say you were only doing your geography homework. Then they can't complain. On second thoughts, ask permission first. And that's what this book is all about. Hot enough to fry an egg, dry enough to drive you mad with thirst, and full of some very prickly characters, deserts are horribly hot potatoes. In desperate deserts, you can fry your brains as temperatures reach 58 Celsius. See the sun blotted out by a deadly storm. Find out how to get water out of a frog. Learn how to survive in the world's driest deserts with Sandy, Ace Explorer, and Camilla, her faithful camel. This is geography like never before. But a word of warning before you read on. Go and fix yourself a good long drink. Come to think of it, fix yourself a fridge full. Discovering the desperate deserts can be horribly thirsty work. To Timbuktu and back to France, 1824. The young man with the mop of brown hair could not believe his eyes. Surely there must be some mistake. He read his newspaper again. Wanted. Intrepid explorer. For expedition to Timbuktu. Must come back alive. First prize, 10,000 francs. Applied to the Geographical Society of Paris. It sent shivers down his spine. The young man's name was René Caillou, 1799 to 1838. He was far too skinny and frail to look like an intrepid explorer, but that was precisely what he wanted to be. Never mind Paris. René wanted to see the world. One part of the world in particular. You see, for as long as René could remember, he dreamed of going to Timbuktu, where the houses were said to be made of gold. There was just one teeny problem. Tantalizing Timbuktu was in Africa. In the middle of the Sahara Desert in Africa, actually. Getting there was going to be horribly tricky. René was born in La Rochelle, France, the son of a baker who liked to drink, and ended up in prison. It wasn't a great start in life for the lad, and worse was to come. What happened was this. René's father and mother died when he was young, and he and his brother and sisters were brought up by his old granny. After leaving school, he went to work in a shoemaker's shop, but he was always late or in trouble. His mind simply wasn't on the job. It was miles away. In Africa. On his days off, restless René shut himself in his room, staring dreamily at the dog-eared map of Africa pinned on the wall. How he wished that he was there. Especially in the bits of Africa mysteriously labeled desert or unknown. Every spare minute was spent with his nose in a book about travel and adventure. No wonder he was late for work. René was so busy reading books that he often forgot to go to bed. Don't try this excuse at home. Now his dreams might just come true. The ad in the paper seemed to be written just for him. This was an opportunity not to be missed. The Geographical Society, too, had heard rumors of Timbuktu's fabulous gold and saw a chance for some serious money-making trade. Before anyone else found out about it, there was no time to lose. René grabbed his chance of a lifetime. Various places in Africa, 1827 to 28. In April 1827, René finally set off for Timbuktu. Actually, he'd arrived in Africa some years earlier, with his granny's blessing. Anything to stop him moping around the house, she said. But he couldn't go anywhere without money. Any money he'd had been spent on getting to Africa. So he got a job in a factory and saved up all his pay. In his spare time, he learned the local desert language and got into training by walking for miles and miles each day. Everything was almost ready. There was just one small, well, large-ish, hitch. You see, Europeans weren't actually allowed into Timbuktu, only Muslims. If Rene was caught, chances were he'd be killed. And that would never do. In order to claim the Geographical Society's prize, he had to make a detailed account of everything he had seen and done in Timbuktu. Did this put him off? No way! He'd come this far and wasn't about to give up now. Instead, Rene came up with a cunning plan. He disguised himself as a Muslim, wearing long, flowing robes and a long, flowing headdress so that no one could see his face. Just blend in. It was brilliant, though he said it himself. He couldn't actually tell anyone else for fear they'd see through his disguise. Tricky. He'd keep his notes hidden in a copy of the Quran, the Muslim's holy book. Then, if anyone saw him reading his notes, he could always say he was praying, and in case anyone asked him why he had such a strange accent, he'd say he'd be kidnapped as a child and carted off to France. Now he was returning home to Egypt. Okay, so it was a bit of a long shot. On April 19th, 1827, Rene finally set off with 5 local people, 3 slaves, a porter, a guide, and the guide's wife. It was a dreadful journey. It was desperately hot, and despite all the training Rene had done, his feet were torn to shreds. His path led through thick, fly-infested forests of grass, up steep mountain paths, through fast-moving streams and swampy bogs. Ooh, ow, ooh, ow. He lost his way 3 or 4 times a day, and several times people almost saw through his disguise. But worse, much worse, was to come. In August, when he was about halfway, Rene fell desperately ill with a nearly fatal attack of fever. He felt rotten. And just as he was recovering from that, what happened? He collapsed with an abominable bout of scurvy, so bad that the skin peeled off his mouth. Yuck! He never could eat properly afterwards. Note, scurvy is a horrible disease you get by not eating enough fresh fruit and veg. You have been warned. Luckily, a kindly villager nursed him back to health with nourishing rice, water, and herbs. Sounds even worse than your school dinner. And as soon as plucky Rene was better, he was back on his, still very sore, feet again. He spent the last bit of his journey traveling by canoe down the Niger, hidden under a mat so that no one would see his face. I didn't know we were taking elephants on this trip. Finally, on April 20th, 1828, just as the sun was setting, brave Rene Kelly reached the desert and Timbuktu. At long, long last, his dreams had come true. Or had they? The books on Africa said that Timbuktu was so fabulously rich that not only were its streets paved with gold, but every house had a golden roof. Every day, it was said, caravans of camels arrived in the city, loaded down with yet more gold. Poor Rene had never been so bitterly disappointed in all of his miserable life. Which just goes to show you should never believe everything you read in books. After everything he'd been through, the heat, the dust, the rice, water, and herbs, he found himself in a city of miserable houses made of mud, where not even the warbling of a bird could be heard. Rene's own words, not mine. There wasn't a golden house in sight. Who's pinched all the gold? The Sahara Desert, Africa, 1828. But there was no time to lose feeling sorry for himself. Getting to Timbuktu wasn't enough. To get his hands on the 10,000 franc prize, he had to get back home again, alive. Now to get back and collect my prize. It was easier said than done. The only other explorer to reach Timbuktu had been savagely strangled to death by his guide. Would Rene live to tell the tale? It was going to be horribly tough. You see, reckless Rene chose to return by a different route, a route that led north, right across the desperate Sahara Desert. It was a journey no European had ever tried before, let alone seen the end of. Things didn't start well. Rene very nearly missed the bus, camel. He'd hitched a lift with the camel caravan, which was going his way, but he was so busy saying goodbye to his new Timbuktu pals that his fellow travelers got fed up and left without him. Wait, stop that camel! Nice chap. Bit odd. Rene had to run so fast to catch them up that he fainted. Luckily for him, someone picked him up and plonked him on his camel. Only another 1,600 kilometers to go. For the next 4 months, Rene, his 400 companions, and their 1,400 camels traveled thirstily across the desperate desert sands. Woe betide anyone who fell asleep in the saddle. If you dropped off, you were left behind. It was tough, but rules were rules. The journey was worse, far worse, than anything Rene had suffered before. Day after day, they trudged slowly across the seemingly endless sands and desolate rocky wastes. The glaring sun was terrible, the sandstorms were worse, blistering their lips and throat. The caravan was attacked by unfriendly locals. What's more, the food, if you could call it food, was absolutely foul, a moldy mixture of flour and honey. And to add insult to injury, Rene was nicknamed Camel Face because of his big nose. But this was nothing compared to the throat-parching thirst. Camel Face, Rene, was thirsty all the time. It was like the worst type of torture. All day long, he could think of nothing but lovely, wet, dripping water. But lovely, wet, dripping water was strictly rationed to one drink a day, and wells were few and far between. Many of them had run dry. Some of his companions were so desperate, they bit their fingers to drink their own blood, or even drank their own urine. And when, finally, the caravan did make it to water, Rene had to fight off the camels to get a drink. Who are you pushing, Camel Face? Eventually, utterly exhausted, burned to a crisp, with his clothes reduced to rags, Rene stumbled into Tangier in Morocco and went straight to the French consul's house, expecting a warm welcome. Guess what? After all he'd been through, the consul mistook Ragged Rene for a beggar and kicked him out on the street. When finally he got back home to France, things began to look up for Rene. Not only was he given a hero's welcome, he was also awarded a medal, a generous pension, and the society's prize. But he had enough of exploring to last him a lifetime and gave up his travels for good. Instead, he settled down and got married. And did he live happily ever after? Not quite. You see, not everyone believed his story. Some people said he'd made the whole thing up for the sake of the money. After all, he couldn't actually prove he'd been to Timbuktu. They only had his word for it. Who do you think was telling the truth? Desperate Desert Fact File. Name, Sahara Desert. Location, North Africa. Size, 9 million square kilometers. Temperature, up to 45 Celsius in the day, down to negative 7 Celsius at night. Rainfall, less than 100 millimeters a year. Desert type, high pressure. See page 28. Desert data, the biggest desert on Earth. It's as big as the USA, or Australia with room to spare. In Arabic, Sahara means desert, so you don't really need to say Sahara Desert, do you? About a fifth of the Sahara is covered in sand. The rest is rocky, pebbly, and salty. About 6,000 years ago, it was green and wet with crocodiles, hippos, giraffes, and elephants. Sandy here. If you're thinking of following in Rene Kelly's footsteps and having your own adventure of a lifetime, you'd be in good company. Plenty of horrible geographers have had a go at exploring the desperate desert. Some of the lucky ones, like Rene, have even made it back alive. Could you stand the heat? Before you saddle up your camel and head off into the sunset, it might be an idea to dust up on your desperate desert know-how. Don't worry, you'll have Camilla and me for company. You never know, it could be a matter of life and death. Don't forget, I'm the real expert. Dry as a bone. There might not be a desert near where you live, but there's plenty of desperate desert around. In fact, deserts cover more than a third of the Earth's surface, and they're growing all the time. But what on Earth are deserts, and who on Earth gave them their desperate name? Horrible geographers can't agree, for a change. Some people blame the ancient Romans. Desert comes from a Latin word which means a deserted or abandoned place. Other people blame the ancient Egyptians. Desert comes from an Egyptian word which means, guess what, a deserted or abandoned place. Desperate, huh? Whoever thought of it first, the word desert stuck. Thank goodness abandoned place didn't catch on. What a mouthful. Though it's a mystery why the Romans had a word for a desert when they lived in the middle of Italy, where there isn't a desert in sight. The expert Egyptians, on the other hand, knew all about desperate deserts. They lived in the Sahara, which, as you know, is the biggest desert on Earth. Not that they visited it very often. They thought the desert was full of demons and that anyone mad enough to go wandering off in it was likely to get their desserts. What on earth are desperate deserts? Warning, you'll need to use your imagination for this next bit. Okay, here goes. Imagine you're walking along a sandy beach on a breezy day. Put your fingers in your ears so you can't hear the sea. It's the middle of summer and baking hot. There's no one else around. Your skin's starting to burn and your lips taste salty and dry. Your throat's so parched you can barely swallow. And when the wind blows, it flings stinging sand straight in your face. But more than anything else in the world, you're absolutely dying for a drink. Trouble is, there's nothing but sand for miles and miles. No water, no shelter, no ice cream van. Desperate, eh? Welcome to the desert. Hot and dry. There are two surefire ways of spotting that you're in a desert, if you hadn't already worked it out. Generally speaking, deserts are, 1, baking hot. During the day, deserts can get desperately hot with temperatures well over 50 Celsius in the shade. Yep, there's shade in the desert, if you can find it. Look out for a rare tree or bush or a shady cave. The ground's hot enough to fry an egg and toast your toes. The hottest temperature ever recorded on Earth was a sizzling 82 Celsius in the Sahara. To get an idea of what this feels like, take the hottest summer's day you can think of. Now double it. Is that hot or what? At night, though, it's a different story. Because there aren't any clouds to trap the heat, temperatures can plummet well below freezing. Desert winters are even worse. Wrap up warm if you're planning a winter break in the Gobi Desert. You can expect teeth-chattering temperatures of negative 21 Celsius and below. Brr, come to think of it, you'd probably be better off staying at home. 2. Bone dry. If you're off to the desert, leave your brolly behind. On second thoughts, take it. It'll make a good sunshade. It's extremely unlikely to rain. That's what makes a desert so desperate. Horrible geographers used to count deserts as places which got less than 250 millimeters of rain a year. That's about the height of the water you have in the bath, if you can remember where the bath is. Which sounds quite a lot, but it's spread out over the whole of the desert. But now they've gone and changed their minds. Geographers are always going and changing their minds. Now they use a newfangled system called an aridity index. Aridity is the tricky technical term for dryness. But dryness index doesn't sound very impressive, eh? It's obviously much too tricky for some horrible geographers. They still stick to the millimeter method. Cowards. Here's how the aridity index works. Note, there are two different versions of this experiment. One's for desert scientists with loads of high-tech equipment. The other's for you to try at home. See how dry a desert is. Version 1. What a desert scientist would do. A. Measure how much rain falls in a year in the desert, using high-tech equipment like rain gauges, radar, and satellites. B. Measure how much water evaporates, dries up in the sun, using more high-tech equipment. C. Divide B by A. See how dry a desert is. Version 2. If you can't get to a desert to do this experiment, don't worry. You can always try it at home. What you do? A. Count the number of cans of pop in your fridge. Say 2. B. Then count how many friends you've got around who all want to drink. Say 8. C. Now divide your friends by the number of cans to give an aridity index of 4. 8 divided by 2 equals 4. Congratulations! Your house is officially semi-desert. Count your lucky stars you don't live in the scorched Sahara. It scores an incredible 200 on the aridity index, which means it loses 200 times more water than it gets. Talk about bone dry. But that's quite enough boring maths for now. Have a can of pop as a reward. No, me! Me! Over here! We should have brought our own! Desperate desert weather. Rain clouds? Where would we be without them? In the desperate desert, of course. Want to know why deserts are so deadly dry? It's because there aren't any rain clouds around. Sand and rocks, yes. Palm trees, maybe. Camels, probably. But rain clouds are extremely rare, which, oddly enough, is what makes them so horribly important. To find out why, you first need to see how a rain cloud grows. 1. The sun heats the land or sea, which warms the air above it. 2. The warm air rises and cools down. 3. As it cools, it turns into droplets of water and a cloud is born. 4. In the cloud, the droplets grow bigger and bigger until they fall as rain. You said it would be sunny all day, you drip. So why don't you get rain clouds in the desert? The trouble is that the warm air doesn't have a chance to cool down. It's so hot in the desert, it dries the air up, so rain droplets rarely form, which is not to say that it never rains in the desert. Take the record-breaking Atacama Desert for a start. Officially, it's the driest place on Earth. Even horrible geographers agree about that. Some parts of the desert went without rain for 400 years, from 1570 to 1971. But desert rain is horribly unpredictable. When it finally rained, it poured and poured and poured, causing chaos and furious flash flooding. A little rain never hurt anyone. Desert weather forecast. It always pays to keep an eye on the weather. Here's the sort of thing you might expect. Today will start off hot and dry, with the wind getting up in the afternoon. There may be a chance of a dust storm or two if the wind is very strong. Expect cooler temperatures by evening. Tomorrow will be much the same, and the next day, and the next day, and the next day. You get very strong winds in the desperate desert because there's nothing to slow them down. They race over the ground, whipping up great choking clouds of dust. I hate these strong winds. Well, I'm not over the moon about them. And it doesn't stop there. Dust from the Sahara gets blown hundreds of kilometers, as far as the USA, where it can fall in the rain and snow, turning them both bright red. Spooky. It must really get up people's noses. Especially as the Sahara is the dustiest desert on Earth, turning up 200 million tons of the stuff a year. How on Earth do deserts happen? Like geography teachers, desperate deserts are all horribly different, but they all have one thing in common. They're all desperately dusty and dry, a bit like geography teachers. Cough, cough, choke, hack. Any rain around simply passes them by. So how on earth do deserts happen? Dip into Sandy's red-hot guide and find out about four different desert types. A. Name, high-pressure desert. Location, on either side of the equator. Aridity index, very high. How they happen? At the equator, warm air rises and blows away to the north and south. There, the air cools down and sinks. How on earth does this make a desert? Good question. Well, meteorologists, geographers who study the weather, call this high pressure because the sinking air pushes down on the earth, putting the earth under pressure. See? And high pressure brings sunny days and clear, cloudless skies. Sounds like perfect desert weather. B. Name, rain shadow desert. Location, on the sheltered side of some mountain ranges. Aridity index, very high. How they happen? This is what happens when a mountain range gets in the air's way. As the air rises up to get over the mountaintops, it cools down into droplets and forms rain clouds. But by the time they've reached the other side of the mountains, they've dumped all their dampness as rain. So the spooky thing is that you can have desert on one side of the mountains and fabulous forest on the other. C. Name, inland desert. Location, in the middle of some continents. Aridity index, very high. How they happen? Usually, winds blowing across the sea carry masses of moisture for making rain clouds. But these inland deserts are so desperately far away from the sea, they don't stand a chance of rain. By the time the air is blown for thousands of kilometers, any clouds and rain are long, long gone. D. Name, coastal desert. Location, off the western coast of some countries. Aridity index, very high. How they happen? Chilly currents flowing off the coast cool the air blowing inland, so it's much too dry to create a cloud. But fit some fog lamps on your camel. In the morning, the ground's still cold. It hasn't had a chance to warm up in the sun. In turn, it cools the air above it. Then the air condenses, turns into liquid water, and forms a thick, clammy blanket of fog. B. bet that's the last thing you expect to find in the desert. Desperate Deserts Top 10. Over the page, there's a handy map to show where on Earth the top 10 deserts are and the type of desert you might just find yourself in. Earth-shattering fact. It's official. Icy Antarctica is a desert. Believe it or not. It may not have sand dunes, it may not have camels, but it's as desperately dry as a load of old bones. On average, Antarctica gets a measly 50 millimeters of rain or snow a year, and this is quickly frozen solid. In some places, it's been an amazing 2 million years since the last shower. Dying for a drink. Faced with all the things desperate deserts can throw at you, the horrible heat, the dust, the fog, it's a wonder anyone goes there at all, or comes out alive. You need to be tough to survive in the desert. As this terrible true story shows, picture the scene. The Sonoran Desert, USA, August 1905. Dawn was breaking over the desert. It was going to be another desperately hot day. Scientist William J. McGee lay fast asleep on the ground. A lizard strolled lazily across his leg, and somewhere in the distance, a hungry coyote howled. William shifted slightly in his sleep, but he didn't wake up. He'd been in the desert for 3 long months, studying desert weather and wildlife. Compared to the deadly creatures he'd seen, lizards were, pussycats. Besides, he was having a very strange dream. In it, a herd of huge cows was galloping towards him, closer and closer, raising clouds of dust with their hooves. Suddenly, one cow let out an ear-splitting roar. This time, William woke up with a start. What the? Who's the... Mommy! He mumbled, looking around leerily and reaching for his gun. Of course, there wasn't a cow to be seen anywhere. Then William realized what it was he'd heard. He hadn't dreamed the scream. It was real, and whoever had made it wasn't far away, and desperately needed his help. Wide awake now, William scrambled to his feet and peered over the edge of the nearby cliffside. A dreadful sight met his eyes. A man lay on the ground. He was barely alive, his body a bag of bones. There was no time to spare. If he didn't have a drink soon, he'd die. William sloshed water over the man and gave him a sip of whiskey to drink. Desperate times called for desperate measures. Then, slowly and painfully, through parched lips, the man began to tell William his story. "My name is Pablo Valencia," he gasped. "My friend and I came to the desert to look for gold. There's an old gold mine we heard of, and we wanted to make some money. We knew that summer wasn't the best time to come, but we thought, what the heck, we'll be okay. Anyway, somehow we got split up. My friend had our horses and supplies. I was left stranded and alone with only a canteen of water to drink. It was desperate. I tried to get back to the waterhole. I knew it must be nearby, but the heat was so terrible. It played tricks on my mind, and I couldn't find the way. At the end of the first day, my water ran out. It was terrible.